Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know, there's nothing like a good book to help pass the time on a summer's day. Sadly, that's not what we've got for you. Instead, it's the latest edition of the Fed's Beige Book, their regional survey of the U.S. economy. And I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but it does not have a happy ending. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter's The Splendid Tables How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's Wednesday today, July 23rd. Glad you could be with us. It's not like the Beige Book is going to show up on bestseller lists anytime soon. In fact, it's free on the Fed's website if you really can't help yourself. Although, it's very nearly required reading as Mr. Bernanke and company try to figure out what to do about interest rates. The Fed said today prices were up and consumer spending was down almost everywhere. Real estate was still weak and wages were flat. But it's that bit about consumer spending that's the big one. Because if we're not buying, who are companies supposed to sell to get the economy going again? Some earnings announcements this morning gave us some idea. From Washington, Jeremy Hobson has the story.
McDonald's reported net income of $1.2 billion in the second quarter. On the shareholder conference call this afternoon, COO Ralph Alvarez wasted little time talking about U.S. sales, even though they were up. It was all about growth in Europe, the Middle East, and Asia.
In Japan, the addition of several new items to the 100-yen menu, including premium roast coffee and desserts, is resonating with our customers.
It was the same story with earnings today from Pepsi, Whirlpool, and drug maker GlaxoSmithKline. Here's CEO Andrew Witty talking about the quarter's results for a popular asthma drug.
Europe continues to perform extremely well. We see our emerging markets and the launch in Japan going well.
As for the U.S., it's okay. Larry Horowitz is a senior economist at Decision Economics. He says relative strength in foreign markets is allowing many U.S. companies to offset losses here at home. And then there's the weak dollar, which makes U.S. goods cheaper abroad.
My estimate is for many of these companies, about half to two-thirds of the gains they're getting are currency-driven gains as opposed to volume. But that still leaves good volume gains.
Horowitz says some industries like home building and telecommunications will have a harder time shifting business abroad. But for other sectors like heavy equipment and computers, there's already a huge push underway to market internationally and build infrastructure outside the U.S. As Horowitz puts it, that's where the growth is. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Hard-hit banking stocks have been having a pretty good couple of days. In some cases, it's been the better-than-expected paradigm that a $2 billion loss is better than $8 billion. Or it's been an assumption that the worst is over and things can only get better from here, witness Wachovia yesterday. Whatever the rationale, it's going to take a lot of cash to shore up bank balance sheets, which means it's time to sell, as Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
With billions of dollars in bank write-downs, something had to give. The Wall Street Journal reported today that some banks are considering selling off their money management units. Bernie McGinn runs McGinn Investment Management. He says for banks desperate to raise money, those units are an obvious place to start.
They don't really have a choice. These are the assets that are worth the most, and they're trying to fix their balance sheets by selling the things that are the most valuable.
Money management units hold mutual funds, IRAs, and other personal investments. McGinn says a big reason buyers like them is because they're easy to value. Jim Barth of the Milken Institute says likely buyers could include private equity funds or other better-off banks who'd like to get hold of a regular stream of cash.
These particular units provide a steady source of fee income, which obviously a lot of banks would like to do. That is to rely more heavily on fee income, less heavily on volatile interest rate income.
Because money management operations are so profitable, Bernie McGinn says, banks aren't eager to lose them. He says banking stocks may have rallied recently, but struggling banks face pressure from regulators to keep certain amounts of cash on hand.
The only asset they have left to get them over the finish line or to get them into regulatory compliance is that asset.
Banks that sell these in-house money spinners will get an infusion of much-needed liquidity. But McGinn says that won't stop some of them from failing anyway. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo is set to weigh in on the fallout from the credit crunch. There are reports today he's considering securities fraud charges against UBS. Cuomo certainly wouldn't be the first to accuse UBS of wrongdoing. A number of lawsuits have said that the bank and some other firms misled investors about the safety of a certain kind of investment. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains.
The investments in question are called auction rate securities. They're long-term bonds whose interest rates are set by auction, or were set by auction. Sales ground to a halt earlier this year after the credit market seized up. Investors are now cut off from their money. Attorney Harry Miller represents clients in lawsuits against UBS and other firms that sold auction rate bonds. He says UBS brokers told his clients these investments were as safe as cash.
They thought that they would be able to get their money at any time that they needed it, and that the only difference was that there was a slightly higher rate of interest on this type of account.
These sales methods prompted the state of Massachusetts to file suit against UBS last month. The state charged the bank with fraud and dishonest conduct. In New York, the Attorney General's office didn't return calls today. UBS said in a statement that a complaint from New York would be disappointing. It says it's working with regulators. Last week, the bank agreed to buy up to $3.5 billion worth of the securities back from investors. Matt Fabian follows the bond market for Municipal Market Advisors. He says many banks sold auction rate securities the same way.
It was really similar firm to firm. So you have to expect that these kind of lawsuits and initiatives will continue or increase over the next few years.
Several states are looking at sales practices at Wachovia Securities. Last week, inspectors raided the bank's St. Louis headquarters. Wachovia says it's cooperating. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
It was mostly marching in place on Wall Street today, that despite another $4 drop in the price of a barrel of oil. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Today, the White House announced that the president's changed his mind. He is going to sign the housing bill Congress has been working on after all. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson said this morning he convinced the president to set aside his objections and focus on the bailout for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac instead. The House passed the bill this afternoon, the Senate probably tomorrow. So now that it looks like the rescue package is going to happen, we thought it'd be smart to figure out what's going to happen in the housing market as a result. For that, we've called Nicholas Retsinas at Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. Mr. Retsinas, good to have you with us.
Nice to be with you.
Summarize your thoughts on this bill for me, would you?
It was a better idea 6 months ago. It will help. It won't hurt. It's certainly better than chicken soup in terms of the housing market. It's not going to do any damage to the housing market. I think at best, which is not a bad thing, this should soften and slow down some of the continuing problems in the market. Whether it helps with a rapid recovery, that I'm a little more skeptical of.
Let me ask you about some of the things the president specifically mentioned when he stated his opposition to this bill. The first is that $4 billion worth of community block grants to buy up foreclosed properties. Now that that's going to actually be spent, is that going to change the market?
Well, it'll change in a couple different ways. One of the fundamental problems in the housing market is we have too many homes for sale. Every time a property is foreclosed, that adds one more home for the inventory. If and when this legislation becomes law, state and local governments can use these funds to acquire these properties. At least it'll start to eat at some of that inventory overhang in the marketplace.
If I'm out there shopping for a mortgage in the next couple of months, is this bill going to make my mortgage any cheaper, lower the interest rate?
It won't lower the interest rate. It probably, depending if, one, you have good credit, and two, you do have a down payment, it will probably mean that there'll continue to be mortgage money available. So it'll probably prevent the mortgage rates from rising very sort of much, but it's not really going to do anything to lower the mortgage rate.
It's also got a provision for a new regulator for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two mortgage giants that have been in such trouble. What was wrong with the old one, and why do we need a new one?
Well, that's been a debate for some time. Many people have agreed that having a strong regulator gives confidence to the marketplace. As we have seen over the last several weeks, investors are leery of whether Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac will fall prey to this sort of market. What the plan that has been put forward by Secretary Paulson and is likely to be in this bill says not to worry. If that happens, the government will sort of step in. Having a good regulator, a strong regulator, is part and parcel of restoring confidence to these very important institutions.
And in fact, it was Treasury Secretary Paulson who said today that he convinced the president to sign this bill over the president's own objections. So now we have a package which will eventually become law that will let the Treasury Secretary decide when to invest in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, how much money to lend them. Is there no risk in the blank check that he's been given?
Of course there's a risk. Everything the government has done transfers some of the exposure of this sort of failing market to the taxpayer. I think the judgment call that's being exercised, and I think in this case it's a prudent one, that the avoidance of a much larger problem, if nothing were done, is much more worrisome. So the chance of some more activist intervention, as opposed to waiting for the sky to fall in the housing market, I think is probably a good choice.
Is this going to stabilize the housing market, as the White House said today?
Well, it's going to help. The larger issue in the housing market, as I indicated, is the glut of homes that are for sale, both overbuilt as well as sort of foreclosed homes. We have to work that out. Both borrowers and investors have to have some confidence in the market and that it's not going to get worse. This is an effort to bring some stabilization to that market.
Nick Retsinas runs the Joint Center on Housing Studies at Harvard University. We reached him actually on Cape Cod today on vacation. Mr. Retsinas, thanks a lot for your time.
Nice to be with you.
It might not look like it at first glance, but the housing bill is apparently the latest American export. Treasury Secretary Paulson said today the package is, and I quote, a very important message we're sending to investors around the world. Sometimes, though, what's important is not so much the substance of the message, but how it's perceived. Commentator David Frum says that's especially true when it comes to government programs.
It was Niccolo Machiavelli, I think, who suggested that while it was good to be virtuous, it was much more important to seem virtuous. You can update this aphorism from modern Washington, D.C. It's good for a policy to be market-oriented, but it's essential for a policy to seem that way. Two costly programs that otherwise might not have very much in common at all share this seeming quality. The first is cap and trade. That's the remedy for climate change, endorsed by John McCain and Barack Obama alike. Cap and trade limits carbon dioxide emissions. Companies that can reduce their emissions below the caps are then authorized to sell their unused credits to pollute. As companies buy and sell these allowances, a market comes into being. Capitalism. Except that almost everybody who has studied the system has concluded that this market-seeming approach is much less efficient and much more expensive than a straightforward tax. But taxes do not seem very market-friendly. So we'll do it the wasteful way instead. Those now notorious twins, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, are the second bit of market mimicry. Fannie and Freddie are arms of the government, exempt from taxes and backed, as the whole world now knows, by a federal guarantee. The only thing market-oriented about Fannie and Freddie is the staggering pay level they offer their senior executives. John McCain's top economic advisor and many free market economists argue that if Fannie and Freddie are guaranteed by the government, they should be owned by the government. But Fannie's and Freddie's supporters on the liberal side resist this idea. They know that if Fannie and Freddie were perceived as government-owned, the two companies would never be allowed to compete with private firms. So the illusion that Fannie and Freddie are free market entities must be preserved, and the shareholders of these insolvent firms must be protected from consequences that no investor in a truly private sector company would be allowed to escape. That's a pretend market, not a free market.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His latest book is called Comeback: Conservatism That Can Win Again. If you're reading something smart this summer, could be a clever piece of nonfiction about behavioral economics or maybe a novel about a crafty tycoon, send those titles along to us. Go to marketplace.org and then click on the link that says Best Marketplace Beach Reads. The Environmental Protection Agency said this week it needs more time to think about alternative fuels. A couple of months ago, Texas Governor Rick Perry asked for a waiver of federal rules that require ethanol use in gasoline. Perry said those rules are pushing up the price of corn, which is raising feed costs for Lone Star cattlemen. Meanwhile, drivers are looking for an alternative to pricey gas, and they've been disappointed to see biofuels shoot up just as high. From KPLU in Seattle, Tom Bonsi reports the alt-fuel business is proving tougher than anticipated.
$40, E10.
Just off Interstate 5 in Eugene, Oregon, sits a different kind of gas station. It sells only biofuel blends. You can get corn-based ethanol, or diesel drivers can choose from several grades of biodiesel. That's made from vegetable oil. Mason Gaucher was an early customer, now assistant station manager. Even he feels the pinch of soaring prices.
I bike to work more often now that gas prices are expensive.
And you work at a gas station.
And I work at the gas station.
This should have been the dawn of a golden age for biofuels. Instead, producers and sellers are having to scale back their business plans. Refiners are getting hammered by rising crop prices. For example, soybeans have doubled in price over the last year. That translates into around $5 a gallon at the pump for pure biodiesel.
It is really hurting business, you know, as an alternative company, so to speak, and having alternative customers that our target market is more likely to ride a bike or take a bus.
Customer Kerry Leek chooses the biofuel station less often these days. He says he stopped at the bank to make sure he had enough money before coming to the station.
I'm not sure I'm sold on biofuels. Everything I'm hearing, it's like the carbon footprint seems to be pretty high. Plus, it's driving up the cost of food.
Customer Carol Metzler also pays attention to the food versus fuel controversy, but she remains loyal because she wants to reduce the country's reliance on petroleum.
So I've continued to buy here and continued to focus on biofuels because I still think it's part of the solution.
Consumer acceptance is one thing. Then there's the industrial customers who buy by the millions of gallons. Seattle's Metro Transit have been using 20% biodiesel to fuel their buses, but this spring they let the contract expire. Transit Director Kevin Desmond says paying a few cents extra for renewable fuel was tolerable, but today's nearly a dollar a gallon differential forced his hand.
I think what we looked at it, in effect, do you spend $2 million to continue to pay for biofuels but cut service, we made the pretty obvious choice. We're going to preserve service, and we'll set aside the bio program for now until things settle out a little bit better.
Another large volume customer abandoning pricey biodiesel is Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines. Meanwhile, entrepreneur Rob Elam is growing a chain of retail biofuel stations based in Seattle. Is he more cautious now? Yes. Scared? No.
You know, as petroleum goes to 140 a barrel and beyond, there's no end in Iraq in sight, that the people continue to demand something new and a change and empowerment, and they know that, you know, there will be tough choices to be made.
Policymakers keep trying to shape those choices and shore up the industry. Starting next year, federal law requires more ethanol or biodiesel to be blended into regular fuel. Also, grant money and private investment is flowing to companies working on non-food sources for biofuels. In Seattle, I'm Tom Bonsi for Marketplace.
Coming up, closing the door on a public sex scandal.
Well, it doesn't matter whether this is true or false. It's a breach of my new European-style privacy right.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 0.25% today, 29 points to close at 11,632. The NASDAQ ticked up 0.9%, 21 points to finish at 2325. The S&P 500 inched up 0.4%, 5 points to end at 1282. The government's bailout plan for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac drove both those companies' shares up more than 11% today. Airline shares took off as oil prices fell. AirTran Holdings soared 25%. JetBlue bumped 16%. Northwest powered 15% higher, even though the company started the day by reporting a heavy loss. On the downside, Costco lost nearly 12% after it released a profit warning. McDonald's dropped 0.7%, and ConocoPhillips, which reported good earnings before the bell, still slipped nearly 3% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.11%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com.
Every day's marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Senate Judiciary Committee discusses crimes associated with polygamy. The National Association of Realtors reports on existing home sales for June. And in San Diego, Comic-Con 2008 opens. The four-day schedule includes Comic Book Law 101 on intellectual property rights, where you can catch a panel on lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender characters in comics. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Second only to the long tradition of peaceful transfers of political power in this country is the tradition of presidential administrations of both parties trying to sneak in last-minute rule changes on their way out. And so the stories are starting to leak as the clock winds down on the Bush White House, where political appointees at the Department of Labor have apparently been trying to make it harder to regulate workplace exposure to hazardous materials. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
The Washington Post obtained a copy of an unpublished proposal that would force regulators to re-examine the methods they use when determining on-the-job risks. Businesses have long complained that the government overestimates worker exposures to chemicals and toxins. The Department of Labor didn't comment, but one of the agency's former Bush appointees, Diana Furstgott-Roth, says the proposal is long overdue.
It's good science versus junk science.
Roth says existing rules run on the flawed assumption that exposures to workplace toxins are accrued over a lifetime.
These days, workers frequently don't work in the same job for 40 hours a week for a 45-year career.
But critics call that a cheap trick to get businesses off the hook. Penn Law professor Adam Finkel says even if today's workers are more likely to change jobs, they don't necessarily reduce their toxic exposure levels.
If somebody is a brake mechanic and they work for five different brake shops over a 45-year period, they're getting the same exposures for that time.
And George Washington University epidemiologist David Michaels says many of those exposures are at unsafe levels to begin with. He says under the Bush administration, proposals for limiting exposure to cancer-causing silica dust and beryllium have languished on the shelf. And he says the administration's new rule would ensure they stay there.
The next administration will essentially have to either roll this back or accept it, which would mean that any new rule would take a year or two longer to get out.
In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Nobody does tabloid journalism quite like the Brits do. They invented it more than a century ago, and today British tabloids lead the world in brashness and sensationalism. Their pursuit of sex scandals is relentless, but that particular business model is facing a major challenge because there's a big case about the right to privacy going on in the High Court in London. A verdict's expected tomorrow, and it could have a big impact on the way British tabloids operate and on their profitability. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
For the tabloid press, this story has been an absolute humdinger. A high-octane, turbocharged, jet-propelled humdinger.
Helen, start your engine!
The man at the centre of the scandal is the boss of the Formula One motor racing organisation, Max Mosley. The 68-year-old was secretly filmed in a sadomasochistic orgy. Five ladies dressed in military uniform took part. Mosley spoke German. The News of the World described this tableau as Nazi, causing an extra frisson because of Mosley's origins.
And I claim that in the ranks of our Black Shirt Legions, march the mighty ghosts of England's past.
Mosley is the son of this man, Sir Oswald Mosley, head of Britain's fascist party in the 1930s. The story is a tabloid dream. Wealth, lurid sex and deviant politics. Media analyst Chris Horry.
A story like this could easily put on 10% to their total circulation. It could give them another £200,000, £300,000, about $500,000 on the first day.
But that profit could be lost if Mosley wins his case, and it could threaten the health of the entire tabloid industry. The Formula One boss has sued the News of the World not for defamation, but for invading his privacy, now protected by the European Convention of Human Rights.
A couple of years ago, he wouldn't have sued at all because they have the evidence. But now he's saying, well, it doesn't matter whether this is true or false. It's a breach of my new European-style privacy right.
The News of the World claims the story was in the public interest. A public figure was involved in Nazi role play. But Mosley says he only spoke German during the orgy out of courtesy because one of the ladies was German. Tim Luckhurst is professor of journalism at Kent University. He says the courts have recently sided with the targets of the tabloids.
We are increasingly seeing that judges are prepared to protect public figures from the sort of intrusion which in the past was regarded as the lifeblood of British tabloid journalism.
The News of the World got its scoop in the usual way. One of the ladies filmed a Mosley spanking session for a promise of $50,000, although in the end the paper paid her only half the fee, blaming it on the credit crunch. Media lawyer Keith Matheson thinks that Mosley will win the case.
I think the judge will find that you are entitled to keep your sex life private, however peculiar it may seem to other people, however bizarre the acts may be.
The Formula One boss is asking for punitive damages. That could be as much as $2 million. He says if he wins, he'll give the money to a charity promoting motor racing safety. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today to cap off the news about the housing market. San Diego City Attorney Michael Aguirre has the answer to the foreclosure crisis. Aguirre said today he wants to turn San Diego into a foreclosure sanctuary. To that end, he's filed suit against Bank of America and its brand new mortgage division. It used to be the independent company known as Countrywide. He wants to prevent them from repossessing homes in the city. More suits are coming, he said, against Wells Fargo, Washington Mutual, and Wachovia. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow bulked up 29 points, a quarter of 1%. The NASDAQ added 21 points, 9/10%. The S&P 500 rose 5 points. That is 4/10% there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, small towns are being flattened by those high gas prices.
You know, most places that you want to go, like visit your friends or whatever, you can't do it because gas is sky high, you know, especially when you ain't getting paid much.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.